distinct honor and privilege to introduce to you the spike protein defeater and the tip of the spear, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
I'm really, really happy to be here. Every time I come to Cal Jam, I leave with a big pocket of money, and more importantly, with an amazing energy and recommitment. And having been with you, extraordinary chiropractors, people who, because we're all living in kind of silos all the time, and we all go home. And we're surrounded by people who, many of them think we're crazy or dangerous. And coming together with this crowd has been such, it's like plugging into an incredible energy source. And it's also wonderful seeing this army out here of healthy people who are ready for a fist fight. So I want to thank Billy for getting everybody together, for his leadership, for his convening power. I'm about to publish a book on Anthony Fauci. I've been working on it for about a year. And it's an amazing account, because I think it's really going to be able to explain to the American people what's happened to them, this extraordinary transformation of our democracy. How did we walk away from American democracy in 12 months? Now, how did we allow people to abolish our constitutional rights? And people, particularly in my party, who's the Democratic Party, who I grew up feeling, you know, that the First Amendment, the Constitution, was absolutely the most sacred statement in history. That we ought to be able to debate each other. We ought to be able to have civil conversations. We ought to be able to make our point and let ideas triumph in the marketplace, ideas. And understanding that policy in a democracy has to be annealed in the cauldron of debate, and that you cannot quiet people, shut people up. That, you know, if you read Kafka or Orwell or Aldous Huxley or anybody else when we were kids, which was required reading in the schools that I went to, and they all said the same thing. When tyrants want to take over, the first thing they do is abolish freedom of speech. And, you know, we're living in this extraordinary world, and you guys all know it, where if you get injured by one of these, by a medical intervention that is experimental, it's unapproved, it's zero liability, it's financed by the government, and if you get injured by that medical intervention and you try to talk about it on Facebook or Instagram or YouTube, you will be evicted. And the government is working with our communication system to silence people who criticize pharmaceutical products, to silence people who criticize government policies. And of course, the first thing they target was the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. And that's because once you get rid of it, the reason the framers put it in the First Amendment, because they knew that once you get rid of freedom of speech, all the other freedoms are going to fall like dominoes. And that's what happened. They ordered, the government ordered churches closed for a year. And they kept liquor stores open as an essential business. And there's nothing about liquor stores in the Constitution. The churches are in there. And by the way, there is no pandemic exception to the United States Constitution. And George Washington And the framers all knew about pandemics because during the height of the Revolutionary War, there was a smallpox pandemic, and it affected the whole military strategy was built around it. So they knew that pandemics were potentially disruptive, but they chose not to put a pandemic exception into the United States Constitution. They got rid of religious freedom. They got rid of the right to assembly. They told us we all had to stay apart. We couldn't assemble. We had to keep 6 feet between ourselves. They got rid of property rights. They executed a takings of every business in this country without due process, without just compensation. They just said, you close down your business. Do what you're told. They got rid of jury trials. It's not just for vaccine makers. Anybody, any corporation that claims that it is providing a countermeasure is exempt from trial.
Because they're evil.
You cannot sue them, no matter how grievous your injury, no matter how reckless their conduct, no matter how negligent their conduct, no matter how toxic the ingredients, no matter how badly injured you are, you cannot sue that corporation for injuring you. We have the Sixth and Seventh Amendment guarantees of jury trials. Gone. Due process of the law. Gone. Due process is the law that says the government cannot pass a regulation or rule without public participation. Amen. What does that mean? It means, here's what it means. Here's what the statutory and regulatory interpretation of that constitutional amendment say. If the government wants to pass a law, it has to do a number of things. Number one, it has to publish that law, the proposed rule. And when it publishes it, it has to publish a rationale. That means an environmental impact statement, which is a cost-benefit analysis. It has to disclose all the bad things that are going to happen as a result of that law, and it has to explain why the good things are going to outweigh the bad things. They're required. It's called an environmental impact statement. A regulatory impact statement, which essentially does the same thing, an economic impact statement. None of that was ever done for any of these, for the lockdown. Tony Fauci, when he was asked, did you ever look at the economic implications, the impact of the lockdown, he said, no. Well, you know, there's a lot of information about what happens to public health and to mortalities when you cause unemployment. And the reason for that, there was a whole cottage industry in the 1980s in the economics field that evolved because of these big downsizing of these giant corporations, and people, economists and social scientists, were looking and saying, what happens to a society? And all these people suddenly lose their jobs. And there's a very famous study that was published in 1982 that looked at these, that has been cited thousands of times in the literature. And that study said that for every 1 point in unemployment, there are in America, there will be 37,000 excess deaths. About 9,000 of those are heart attacks. About 900 of those are suicides. There's stress-related deaths. There's deaths that are related to people losing their insurance coverage. And on and on and on. And many, many accidental deaths. In addition to that, for every 1 point in unemployment, there are 4,000 extra imprisonments. 3,300 extra condemnations or entrances to mental institutions. Unemployment is a health crisis. And that was when our population was half of what it is today. So you're talking about 70,000 deaths for every point. Well, we don't know how many people died of the lockdown. We don't know if more people died of the lockdown than died of COVID, because they deliberately obscured all of the data that has to do with this. And you know that from the beginning. They were lying from the beginning. They have a In every way, they were lying about the PCR test. They were lying about their modeling that said 22 million people will die in a year, and that's why in the first year, the modeling that was paid for by Bill Gates from the Royal School of London and IMHA, and then weaponized by Tony Fauci. Yeah. And then the PCR test, which were weaponized by Tony Fauci, they said, dial the amplifications up to 40 so we can create a case endemic. And the day they released the vaccine on January 6th, they dialed it back down to 28. Yeah. So that they can tell all of these suckers that the vaccine is what caused the decline in deaths. They changed the way that we look at death. The coroners are instructed to assess deaths on death certificates. So if you had a positive COVID test, and now we know Germany came out with these data today, 70% of the people who had positive COVID tests never had an infection. Yeah. So, if you had a positive COVID test 60 days ago, and you climbed a tree and fell down and killed yourself, you died of COVID. If you died in a car accident, or if you drowned, you died of COVID. The coroners were ordered. That's how we want you to assess it. And even CDC has admitted that only 6% of the 600,000 people that they claim died of COVID had only COVID. The average number of potentially lethal comorbidities for the other 500,000 is 3.8. 3.8 potentially deadly comorbidities that could have killed them. We don't know. Nobody knows because they deliberately obscured it, and they deliberately screwed up the VAERS system. The VAERS system, which your doctor, you're probably the only doctors in America that ever heard of it. And they don't use it. They're telling people in San Diego, the head of infectious disease at the hospital has had all these myocarditis cases that have come in San Diego, kids with myocarditis, and he is ordering the doctors in that hospital not to report it to VAERS. And you hear these stories all the time. We know that there are cases and deaths being removed from VAERS. This is not conspiracy. We can show the number, the actual case numbers. Even without all this direct cheating, the system is designed to fail. In 2010, HHS, because everybody said VAERS doesn't work, and you need VAERS now, because they're giving us an experimental vaccine that, you know, that is in the phase one trials for the Moderna vaccine, there was 100% injury rate after the second vaccine. 21% of the high-dose group were so badly injured that hospitalization or medical intervention was required. 6% in the low-dose group. These are very, very reactogenic products. And even with all the cheating, we're seeing VAERS now looks like a hockey stick. Half of the deaths, half of the injuries that have been caused by all 72 vaccine doses in the last 80, since 1986, since they created VAERS, half of the injuries are caused by these vaccines since January. Half of all injuries. These are very fun. What HHS acknowledged in its own study, which is called Lazarus 2010, and any of you can look it up, is that fewer than 1% of cases are captured by VAERS. VAERS is designed to overlook 99% of the cases because they don't want people to be able to make a rational choice. They do not want us to exercise critical thinking. They do not want us to have the data. And they have robbed us of our constitutional rights. And, you know, as I was saying, if you want to pass a law, you got to do the environment, publish it, publish the proposed rule, do the environmental impact statement, then there's a 90-day or 60-day comment period. You can squeeze that if you're in a rush. You can do 30 days. But everybody affected by that law has a right to comment, and the government has to reply. So if you own a business and you see this, you know, this lockdown coming at you, and you say, look, my particular business has no risk to people. There's no reason it should be closed, or I can figure out a way to operate it to reduce that risk, so you don't need to close me down. You have the right to tell the government you need to amend that law to make exemptions. And that's how laws are made and rules are made. Regulations. I'm not talking about laws that Congress votes on, which they can do anything they want, as long as it doesn't violate the Constitution. But when a regulator does it, they're required to listen to people and they're required to accommodate them. And then, at the end of that, and by the way, they have to tell their rationale. So Tony Fauci would say, here's the scientific studies that justify a lockdown. Here are the scientific studies that justify masks. He has 22 mask studies today on the NIH website. And every one of them says the same thing. Masks don't work. And by the way, you know, I've been agnostic on masks. I have nothing against masks. If masks prevented the spread of the disease, and I'm protecting my community and protecting older people who are vulnerable, I'd be the first one to strap on a mask. So I went out, and look, I have a big staff now, and all they do is scientific research. And I said, let's take a part of our website and go on to PubMed, which is the archive for every peer-reviewed study in the world, and let's put all the studies up there, the ones that say they work and the ones that say they don't work. We couldn't find any that said they work. And you know what what I thought was, there's no way that they work outside, okay? If I hike every day in the Santa Monica wilderness, and I see these angry people walking by me with their masks on, and cursing at me, and I don't say anything, but I'm thinking, this person has lost their mind. And the reason I know, because I do science for a living. That's what I do. I've tried over 500 lawsuits. Almost all of them involve scientific controversies. I cross-examine experts. I direct examine them. I help them put together their testimony. So I know how to read science. And I know how small a virus is. Here's my initial assumption. My initial assumption is the mask probably worked for bacteria, because bacteria are pretty big. But there's no way they work for a virus, because it's like viruses. So the caliber of the mask, of the holes, even in the what is an N42 95 mask? Those ones have much lower caliber. The ones that you buy at the drugstore that we all have to wear, those things, the caliber on those holes is 200 to 1,000 times the size of a virus. So it's like trying to stop a mosquito with a chain link fence. So my assumption was they probably work on bacteria. But we started, and they probably work in institutions. Oh, if you're in a surgery theater, let's say you're the person with your chest cavity open, you want your doctor wearing a mask so that he doesn't sneeze into your chest cavity. This was my assumption. But when I actually read the studies, what they said is even in an institution, they do not work.
Yep.
And in fact, it was, again, in 1982, the Royal Hospital of London did a massive study because they said, we've been using masks for 60 or 80 years. We've never done a double-blind placebo study on them. So let's do it. And what we'll do is we'll tell everybody to take off their masks for 6 months, and we'll put everybody masks on everybody for 6 months, and then we'll look at the results. What they found was that when they took off the masks, even in the surgery theaters, the infection rates went down.
Yep.
I can't tell you why. I can only tell you that that's what that study says. But it doesn't mean it's true. You know, there are all kinds of there's all kinds of failures that can happen in, when you're analyzing data and statistics. And you find anomalies all the time. So I just assumed that was an anomaly. But then my people kept saying, I said, see if there's any more institutional studies out there. And they kept coming up with new ones every day. And they all said the same thing. You can go to our website and you can read them. It doesn't mean it's true because none of them are testing for coronavirus. You know, they're all testing for flu or other viruses. So there's very, very little on coronavirus. There is now one study that they did in Denmark that showed a slight benefit to masks, but it was below statistical significance, and it was a massive study. That's the only one that they have. And so, you know, to me, if we were doing a, if this was a real rulemaking and they tried to pass that rule, and at the end of all that, the comment period, there's a hearing where there's an administrative law judge. And lawyers like me can go in and we can cross-examine all of Tony Fauci's witnesses. He used to bring in all of his witnesses to testify what studies he relied on. He didn't have any. And we can cross-examine them. And then they get to cross-examine ours, and we direct-examine them. And then there's a judge there that has to make a decision, but he has to make it rationally based on the evidence. He can't make an arbitrary and capricious decision. If he does, you can appeal it. Those are the protections that the U.S. Constitution gives us in rulemaking. We don't just tell a doctor, you know, trust the expert. Trust the expert. That's not democracy, and it's not science. Listen, I have bought hundreds and hundreds of cases. Every case I bring, they have an expert, and I have an expert. And they say completely different things. And they're experts in exactly the same field. You can't say trust the experts. You have to use critical thinking. My uncle, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, all of the experts told him, you've got to drop a nuclear bomb on Cuba, or at least bomb the 63 Russian missile emplacements. And my uncle said to him, literally every one of his experts from the intelligence apparatus and the Pentagon said, you have to do this. And all of his State Department people and everybody. And he said, let me see the aerial photos. And he looked at him and he said, who's manning those gun emplacements? Are those Russians or are they Cubans? And the CIA said, they're Russians. And he said, what happens if I kill a Russian gun crew? What does Khrushchev have to do then? And he said, don't worry about it. He won't care. And my uncle at that point said, we're not going to bomb them because it's going to be a nuclear war and it's going to annihilate the globe and I'm not going to be responsible for the deaths of 130 million Americans and 200 million Russians. So he listened to the experts, but he exercised critical thinking, and that is our job in a democracy. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit of history. You'll understand why I'm telling you this history in a moment, and the history, and this is something we all need to understand, understand the larger view of what's happening to us right now. Well, let me go back and say one other thing about masks. If you look at every totalitarian society in the history of mankind, the the first essential task that they all exercise is to destroy every vector for self-expression. So when Hitler went into Romania, when he went into Czechoslovakia, and when he went into Poland, the cassava was told before he went in, the first thing you do is go kill all of the university professors, all of the poets, all of the artists, anybody who does self-expression. Because what dictators really want is they want to rule every aspect of human conduct down to what you do in your home and your speech and the way you think. They want total control over human conduct. And the what is the thing? What is the asset that we all have? It is the most potent vehicle for self-expression. It's the human face. That's why evolution and God gave us 42 muscles in our face so that we could communicate skepticism and cynicism and humor and laughter and love and solidarity and understanding. And there's no greater exercise of power than a dictator who can tell you to cover your face, because it keeps people apart. And if you look at the most totalitarian, the most utterly totalitarian regimes that exist throughout history, they have, that is what they have strived for, get people to cover their faces. And, you know, the best example today are some of the Islamic theocracies in Saudi Arabia particularly. And by the way, if a woman or a man wants to cover their face for religious reasons, I completely respect them, and they have their right. The thing I don't want is a government to tell them to do it. That government, you go to jail if you're a woman. And it's not a coincidence that you will also go to jail if you're a woman and you try to drive a car or get a license. Or exercise your creativity in almost any way, including the way that you dress, the colors that you wear. You can go to jail, and worse. You can, this is a regime that beheads people every Tuesday in the principal square in Jihad, for a lot of them for minor crimes, for self-expression. And, that's why that mask is so appealing to totalitarian regimes. And, powerful entities within our society, the corporate elite, the oligarchy, the technocratic elite, they love pandemics, the same reason they love wars, because they're opportunities of convenience to increase their power. And what do they want to do? They want to shift wealth from obliterate the middle class, which is the power of a democracy, and shift the wealth upward. And then to cover their tracks and to make sure nobody complains, they have to obliterate constitutional rights so that nobody can talk about it, and nobody can say, and by the way, the lockdowns shifted $1 trillion of wealth north. And where did it go? To Mark Zuckerberg, to Jeff Bezos, to Bill Gates, to Sergey Brin, the same people who are censoring criticism of the lockdown. These are the people who are cashing in on it. So I'm going to do a little bit of a history lesson here. And I'm going to start with the Atlantic Charter. In World War II, the Atlantic Charter was probably one of the great emblems of American idealism. Winston Churchill wanted us to get in the war, and Franklin Roosevelt said, we are not going to get into the war. We are a colony ourselves, and we do not believe in imperialism. And if we're going to go into the war, you have to agree that after the war, all the allied nations are going to release all of their colonies to self-governance and self-rule. And Winston Churchill, kicking and screaming, signed the Atlantic Charter because he needed us to come into the war. And after the war, the nationalist movements and the Atlantic Charter forced those nations to let go of their colonies. And the colonies had been the principal source of wealth for Europe for 200 years. But it created a vacuum. And it turned out that American companies and American military went into that vacuum. And originally what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex used the excuse of Soviet expansionism and said, we have to establish bases in all these countries to fight communists, and what can we really do? We made agreements to keep in power any tin horn dictator who proved his environmental bona fides by opening up his countries to U.S. multinationals. And it was a way of getting American companies in to get their lumber, their grain, their minerals, their oil, etc. And by the end of the Cold War, we had 650 bases, military bases, in those countries all over the world. And those military bases allowed our corporations to go in and exploit them. Oil companies, pharmaceutical companies, etc. And then, on my birthday in 1961, a week before my uncle took the oath of office, which I was at that event, I had been at the convention out here the previous summer with him, Dwight Eisenhower, who was the outgoing president, made the most important speech of his career and arguably the most important speech in American history. And he warned Americans that there was a great combine that would endanger and crush and subvert all of American values. And he called it the military-industrial complex. His original speech said military-industrial corporate complex. And it was this combination of military contractors and industries that profited off of of these military interventions by being able to be allowed into all these countries abroad. And he said, America cannot be an imperial country abroad and remain a democracy at home. It will destroy our democracy and all of our values if we let this combination take over our country. My uncle took that very seriously and had the same idea and came into office determined to rein in the military and the intelligence, and he spent the 3 years that he was president fighting the CIA. He fired the top three guys, Allen Dulles and the other two guys, top guys at the CIA, Bissell and Cabal, and fighting his own Pentagon brass. When they told him he had to go into Laos, he said no. When they told him he had to send 250,000 combat troops to Vietnam, he refused to do it. He didn't send any combat troops. He sent 16,000 advisors, fewer people, and he sent to integrate the University of Mississippi to one black man enter the University of Mississippi. He was killed, I believe, by those forces in 1963. 6 months later, Vietnam, Johnson sent the 250,000 troops to Vietnam, and it was our war. And my father ran in 68 fighting that war, specifically to end that war and end military domination of our country by the Pentagon and the CIA. He died in that battle as well. But then what happened? 1988, the Berlin Wall comes down and the Soviets fold their tents. And we are promised a peace dividend. Do you remember them talking and saying we were going to get a peace dividend? All that money, the billion-dollar stealth bomber that couldn't fly in the rain, and that money we were going to now be able to spend on schools and hospitals and healthcare and make our country the shining alabaster city on the hill, the exemplary democracy of mankind, finally bringing up all that war money to bring it home and create it and live up to our promise as Americans. But there were a cohort of people, part of that complex, when they heard peace dividend, they thought, that money's coming out of our pockets. And we need to keep building the weaponry. And so, 4.5 years later, the first World Trade Center bombing happened. And all that money that was headed for the civilian use suddenly was a screeching halt. And it began being redirected to to Islamic terrorism. And then, you know, and then 7 years after that, we have the bombing of the World Trade Center, and huge amounts of money start pouring into that space. But from the beginning, the military knew that terrorism was not a really good thing. It had an advantage. It would not let us down like the Soviets did by quitting, because it's not a nation, it's a tactic. And it's never going to go away. And Dick Cheney promised a long war that would last for generations and keep us in 50 countries around the world. And it did that. It kept us to all of those bases that we were supposed to leave. Suddenly, we had 850 bases around the world fighting Islamic terrorism. So all those people got their way. But it wasn't great because it's not a good long-term way of keeping people really frightened. Because after 9/11, on average, Islamic terrorism was killing fewer Americans every year than lightning strikes. And how long can you keep people saying, yeah, we're going to give 50% of our budget to something that, you know, kills fewer than Americans than lightning? They needed an enemy that could get into everybody's home and kill your family. And that was bioterrorism. And that's when the biosecurity agenda happened. So if you remember, and they knew this from the beginning, and we have it, like, when you read my book, you'll see all these documents. 14 days after 9/11, we had the anthrax attacks. And the anthrax attacks were the way the military justified attacking Saddam Hussein. Because Saddam Hussein, as we all know, had nothing to do with 9/11. We were allowed, 9/11 says, yeah, you can attack Afghanistan, but there was nothing to bomb in Afghanistan. And as Donald Rumsfeld said, that's his quote, they wanted to attack Iraq. And the anthrax gave them the reason. That's what Judith Miller of the New York Times and all of these other, the whole military complex were saying, yeah, Saddam Hussein said that he's got this huge weapons of mass destruction, these bioterrorism weapons that he's going to come after us, and we're all vulnerable. That's why we got to go get him. Well, then we went, and anthrax was the reason. But a year later, the FBI had done its study, and it acknowledged that that anthrax they fingerprinted. It came from one of three U.S. military labs, DSL labs. There's no, this is not controversial. Everybody knows that today. Somebody associated with the U.S. military sent those out. And who did they send them to? They sent them to the senators who had voted against the Patriot Act. And that's what got everybody on board. But immediately, so this was on 10-4. You remember 9/11, but 10-4 was the anthrax attack. And starting on 10-4, we started pouring huge amounts of money into biosecurity. And that's when we built, well, you know, we had done biological weapons in 1943. By 1969, we had achieved nuclear equivalence. We could kill as many people with a biological attack as we could with a nuclear bomb. That year, Nixon shut down the whole program. And we signed an international treaty saying it's illegal to make biological weapons and it's illegal to store them or to use them or anything else. But what happened? After 9/11, the White House said, well, you can make defenses to biological attacks. And the defense is called gain-of-function studies. Because a gain-of-function study, you don't have to use gain-of-function to make a vaccine. In fact, we don't know of any vaccines that have been made from it. But it was a way of them saying, we are making vaccines, when we're actually making weapons. And Tony Fauci's military budget went from zero to $1.6 billion a year. Tony Fauci has a $6.1 billion annual budget from us, from the taxpayer, but he's got another $1.6 billion for the military. The reason they give him that money is to do these kind of bioweapons and biodefense studies. And in order to hold on to that funding stream, he's got to continue to justify himself. So in 2014, when a lot of these bugs escaped from his labs, he built four brand new labs with that money, including the one in North Carolina, one in Galveston, he rebuilt Fort Detrick. And they were all making these gain-of-function bugs, and four bugs escaped that year. And luckily, they didn't start a pandemic. It was known that they had escaped. And 300 scientists sent a letter to Obama saying, you've got to stop Tony Fauci from doing gain-of-function studies. And Obama declared a moratorium and told him, you can't do it anymore. Secretly, he killed 21 of his studies, but he kept the worst one going, which is the one that he did with Ralph Barrick and Jingzi Li, Jingzi Shi, who is the bat lady, from Wuhan. And then he took a whole bunch of other money, about $7 million, and he gave it to the Wuhan lab so that he could do it offshore, outside of the nosy oversight of the White House. And he didn't want it known that he was doing it, so he laundered it through a bioweapons grifter named Peter Daszak. And the reason he knew about him is because the Pentagon was doing bioweapons, its own bioweapons gain-of-function studies, and they were also laundering the money through Daszak to the Wuhan lab, where those scientists were working with the Communist Party and the Chinese military. And now, one of the things that I've learned, how many of you have heard of Event 201? Okay, so that was a simulation, and it was, these guys were like Nostradamus, right? They predicted to the month exactly what was going to happen. And they didn't tell us that it was already happening. In October of 2019, when they did that, it had already escaped and it was circulating Wuhan. But what a lot of you may not know was that there were at least 10 more of those. And the first ones started, they were run by the CIA and by the military in 1998. They did another one in 1991, and then they did about eight more. In names like Dark Winter and the Crimson Contagion. And what they did, what were they doing? Why were they doing this? Why were they enacting? All of them have the same script. There's a lab, there's a pandemic. Most of the pandemics are lab escapees. Weirdly. So there's a pandemic, as was Event 201. Event 201, the fourth simulation, all they're talking about is how do we impose censorship to stop people from talking about the fact that this may be a lab escapee. That's what they're doing. They have the head of the Chinese CDC there talking about we got to shut people up if they start saying this. George Gale is his name. We had the head of the former deputy director of the NSA and the CIA who was in that room. We had all of these other people, and they're all saying we got to quiet people down if they start talking about this being maybe a lab leak. Oh, but they did this 10 times before, and they always do the same thing. And the weird thing about them is they keep planning pandemics. They always do the same thing. There's a pandemic, and then there's one solution. We got to get to a vaccine. Nobody talks about, let's build our immune systems. Let's protect the U.S. Constitution. How about warehousing, stockpiling vitamin D and others? How about right now, let's find some therapy. repurpose therapeutic drugs that are already being manufactured, that are available everywhere, like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. You know, that's what Tony Fauci does in his lab. What he does in his lab is he has thousands, tens of thousands of petri dishes with coronavirus and SARS and MERS culture and Coxsackie virus and polio all being grown in these little colonies. And what they do is they test molecules to see what kills them. And the molecules that you... And then they take the molecule... If they find a molecule and it kills all the coronavirus in the petri dish, and they give it to rats and see if it kills the rat. If it doesn't kill the rat, then they say, hey, this could be a good drug. But, and that's how they do it. And then he farms it out to his PI. That's what they usually do. But the best way to do it is you take drugs that have already been approved because you already know they're safe, so you don't have to do the animal studies. And you drop them in the petri dish. And if one of them kills the coronavirus, then you say, hey, let's stockpile this for the next time we get a coronavirus pandemic. Well, they did that in 2005. And we know this because they published a study in The Lancet. And it said, this hydroxychloroquine kills the crap out of coronavirus. Not only that, but if you put it first in the petri dish, no coronavirus will grow in it. So it is a prophylactic and it is a cure. In 2008, they reproduced that study and found the same thing. Oh, what message did they take? The message they took is in January, as soon as they knew coronavirus was on the loose, the French government, the Canadian government, governments all over the world where hydroxychloroquine was available over the counter, all of a sudden, they made it a class 2 poison so nobody could get it. Tony Fauci got all of his big shot friends from Sanofi, from Novartis, and Bayer to give him all of their stocks of coronavirus from the national stockpile, and he locked the door with 29 locks so nobody could ever get it. 63 million doses he's got sitting there rotting. Some governments began putting doctors in jail who prescribed it. They knew the only way they were going to get the vaccine is if they prolonged this pandemic. And if they made it worse, and you guys know what they did with the Surgisphere studies, where they actually murdered people, and the Brazilian government is prosecuting them for homicide because they gave 5 times the lethal dose to old people to kill them in order to prove that it was dangerous, too dangerous. And that is where the Fauci's recommendation comes from. It's too dangerous. Why does he think it's too dangerous? Because of a JAMA study where the authors of that study are currently under prosecution by the Brazilian government for homicide, for deliberately killing people. So, but what he's supposed to do, why didn't he do that? He didn't do that in all of these simulations. In all of these simulations, they practice the same thing. They practice, we hear about it, we flood the zone with propaganda, we censor people who talk, we develop an EUA vaccine, we give the vaccine company immunity from liability. This is the planning they were doing. We do lockdowns. We do masking. We do social distancing. We put the entire globe under house arrest. We create a... And all these people who are doing it, and every one of them, there are CIA people who are psychological warfare experts. And they're using the same techniques that the CIA has been using for 80 years to destroy indigenous cultures by causing social chaos, causing loss of identity, causing loss of income, and coming in with a powerful central government and asserting powerful controls. All of those, that's what they were drilling. And these were signaling exercises. These were exercises where they were bringing people in who were powerful people. Senators like Sam Nunn, Gary Hart, all of these other, all of them had CIA officials. They all had NBC, ABC, Forbes magazine, Bloomberg, people participating. And they were all told, this is how you handle a pandemic. This is the only way to do it. Social controls, totalitarian rule, keep everybody under house arrest, and in a hostage crisis, to inspire, to induce a psychological state that is technically known as Stockholm Syndrome, where the entire nation is rendered helpless, grateful to their captors, believing that the only hope for salvation is through utter obedience. And that is a psychological warfare technique. And the people, the last one they did before Lent 201, it was called Crimson Contagion, but they did it secretly. It was top secret. And they did it in virtually every state with the health officials in those states. So they reenacted what you saw in Event 201. They were reenacting that secretly in every state. And that's why all of these people, why it seemed so overwhelming to us, and all these people at the same time, the press and everybody, all the health officials were saying the exact same thing, like they were reading off the same script. That's how they knew what to do. And there's a famous experiment that happened in the 1970s. It's called the Milgram experiment. Anybody heard of that here?
Yeah.
The Milgram experiment, which is now has been utterly integrated into virtually every psychological warfare manual by all the intelligence agencies on the globe. The Milgram experiment was a Yale doctor whose name was Stanley Milgram. He brought people in. Should I shut up?
No.
Milgram experiment. What he did, he got 300 volunteers from every walk of life, whether rich people, poor people, working class, every kind of person, university professors, everybody, students. And he put them in these experiments, and he told them they were doing something else. But he was really studying them. And what he would do is he had authoritative figures in white lab coats who would come up to them, and they'd be sitting at a table with a dial on it, and he would say, dial it up, and you're going to give the guy on the other side of that wall, who you can't see, an electric shock. And when he dialed it, there'd be an actor on the other side who would scream. And then, and at the top of the dial, it says fatal. And there's a red zone that may be fatal, maybe not. Right? So the doctor, the guys in the white lab coat, tell these people off the street, turn it up. And slowly they get them to turn it, so they all turn it all the way up. And every one of them ended up doing it. And what the Milgram experiment showed is that if a figure in authority, particularly somebody in a white lab coat who you call doctor, if he tells you to do something, even if it violates all your values, it violates all your conscience, it violates all of your essential beliefs, you will do it anyhow. And all they have to do is put a guy who calls himself a doctor on the TV every day and tell people, do what you're told, an entire nation can become slaves.
That's not us. That's American.
Except you guys. anyway, I think
we're
I'm...
not volunteers.
Oh, anyway, I'm going to... you know, I want to just say this, that I am so happy to be here with people who are warriors, who are ready to fight. Who understand what's going on. And, you know, their system is breaking now.
Yeah.
There are so many things that, you know, there are so many parts of the wall, the fortress they built, that are beginning to crumble. And the reason they're crumbling is because we're in a guerrilla war. And we're not going to go head-to-head with them. What we're going to do is we're going to get them one at a time. And that's why people like you and me saying we're not going to wear the friggin' mask. And if you want to talk about it, I will talk about it politely. And here's the information. And by the way, we're going to talk about what's happening with the vaccines. We're going to talk about that. It is absolutely criminal. It is child abuse to give a child a vaccine or to put a mask on. And we're going to keep telling our teachers, and we're going to be fighting the schools, and I can tell you, I am filing lawsuits every week that I can. I'm suing Jeremy Farrar from Wellcome Trust, and I'm suing Tony Fauci, and I'm suing Bill Gates. I have a dream speech. You remember Martin Luther King? My dream is one day I'm going to be sitting across a table from Bill Gates with a sworn deposition. Let me give you some homework, okay? Two things. One is I want to get my picture taken with you all in a second. So I'm gonna move on. Not one at a time, but the other thing is, if you don't even have to go home, while the next guy is speaking, take out your cell phone and buy my book on Amazon. I'm going to tell you this. That 100% of my profits goes back to Children's Health Defense. Right now, the book is pre-ordered on Amazon, and we have about 3,600 pre-orders. If we get to 10,000, the New York Times has to put it number one on its bestseller. And then a whole bunch of other good things happen. All the bookstores have to put it in the window. The airport bookstores have to purchase it. All of these cascading feedbacks happen. So I need you, as part of what you're doing every day, to tell your people, your friends, anybody you see, go buy the book. It's called The Real Tony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Humanity and Democracy. And here it comes. Thank you very much.
Let's give it up one more time for RFK Jr. Hey, Mike, Mary Jane, are we at the capacity to take more donations from the people here?